Big ones, small ones, some as big as your head. I speak, of course, of coconuts. Coconut water, have you had yours this morning? Is that still a thing? I'm uncertain. An extraordinary tree and fruit. A tree that can be used, every centimetre of it, for so many things, fundamental in so many cultures. And, of course, the fruit itself, it's versatile, it's life-sustaining. It's an economy-sustaining food. This is a plant, a fruit of tremendous significance, and one reflected, perhaps, by the fact that Sri Lanka has a minister for coconut. And there's a new book, Coconut, A Global History, and it takes the tale of the coconut from Polynesian mythology to Indian Hindu traditions to, well, to Somerset Maugham, where all good tales should end. It's co-authored by Mary Newman, who joins us from Connecticut, not a place famed for its coconuts. Mary is a former public health specialist who's reinvented herself as a foodie and writer. And she works with her art historian sister. Mary, welcome.
Hi, pleasure to talk with you.
No, I'm guessing no fronds visible from your window as you speak.
Absolutely not. No coconuts here.
Which speaks to the coconut as sort of an emblem of a certain kind of place, does it not? Of sun-kissed tropical splendor.
Oh, it just says exotic. Yes.
Now, it's been called the coconut, the Swiss Army knife of the plant kingdom, which is a wonderful way of looking at it. Why is it such a varied thing? I mean, remind us of this. Give us a sense of its range as a plant.
Well, when explorers would head out, it makes sense to take a coconut with them. The Polynesian explorers would be thinking, well, we should take this for water if we need water, because coconut water, it stays pretty darn good. It initially is totally sterile, but it's still going to be drinkable for a long time. So you've got some water for your trip. You've got some food if you have to eat it. When you get there, you can plant. And as you move along different islands to islands, you keep planting more trees. So when you're coming back, you've got some coconut trees growing. Once they are growing, you can use it to build a house, have shelter. Mm. You can cook with the coconut husks. The coconut shells can be made into charcoal. You can weave those fronds and make a roof to your house. And you can just basically do everything you want to do with a coconut. It's the Swiss Army knife. but it has a lot of uses.
Simply lacks that pointy thing for getting stones out of horses' hooves.
Right. Well, you can use the coconut shell to scoop things out, and so you do use it as a utensil.
Is what you've just described there, is that the way that the coconut spread around the Pacific? Was that is that where things began for the coconut?
That's pretty much what they're thinking, what scientists are thinking. There's two ways. The coconut falls from the tree, and it can bob up and down in the water. It doesn't sink or anything like that, and it's fine in seawater. And it can stay in salt water for about 40 days and follow the tides and go to another island. Yeah, so it can go pretty far. But they think really it was people that probably moved it.
And, of course, those potential uses, they've only expanded over time. And we have coconut oil now for cooking. Fibre for pot plant mulch. It's an incredibly flexible
material. Yes, they can use that fibre to make doormats. I think somebody's using it to stuff mattresses with. I mean, it's like, it's got a lot of uses.
And do we see a lot of research going into this? Is there a bit of an arms race going on with coconuts?
I think what there's a race for is keeping the supply and the demand almost equal. If you convince all the farmers to plant a bunch of coconut trees and there's nothing to do with them, they're not going to make enough money. They're not going to be able to live like that. If you get all these uses together, coconut water becomes the thing and that's all we ever drink, and coconut oil, whatever. But we don't convince the farmers to plant more coconuts, then that's not going to work. So you've got to have this balance. This race is between convincing the farmers and the landowners that they should plant coconuts. It's a valuable crop, and it'll make them money rather than sell to a developer who's going to tear everything down. So you have to make it worth their while, and you can make it worth their while by the government stepping in and helping with developing plants that are sturdier, disease resistant, grow better, those of kinds course. Of things. So that helps the farmer with that, helping them with maybe value added things. So they're not just selling a coconut, maybe they're selling a product made from the coconut, like a jam, turning it into a jam or something like that, something value added so they can sell it for a higher price.
Well,
already doing the oil.
I wonder if, you know, the great minds at work here too could take a potential glut of a product and then turn that into usefulness by creating a demand for something. I wonder if the demand, for example, coconut water, is that an example of that kind of equation?
Right, and it probably is very hard to predict. In the United States, sports drinks have become really popular, and I think coconut water's taken them on head on because it seems more organic. It seems better for you than a whole bunch of chemicals in a neon-colored container. So it's taking off, and it's really going far. But you've got to have the coconut trees growing, and you've got to harvest that water, and that's a little bit more difficult than what they had been doing, selling coconuts.
Yes. Well, which takes us, that idea of, you know, we need more trees, to the Sri Lanka minister for coconut. in 2020, that minister was Arandika Fernando, who legendarily, and this may be available on YouTube, who knows, climbed a coconut tree as a media stunt to draw attention to the shortage of coconuts, then a little bit stuck up there. He wanted every available piece of land in Sri Lanka to be used for coconut cultivation. That's exactly what you're describing.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting, though, that he climbed the tree. That, especially in Thailand, they're really trying to figure out how to get the coconuts out of the trees. And the absolutely easiest and best way, if you want to call efficiency best, is to use monkeys. An adult monkey can pick 1,600 coconuts a day. A human can pick about 80. So you've got a massive difference there. But in order to do that, have the monkey do that, you pretty much have to make them a slave. You have to do inhumane or whatever the word for animals is.
Well, I think those monkeys need to unionize as a matter of some priority.
Yeah, so it's kind of difficult. And so governments are trying to figure out how to make most of the human's time is spent climbing up the tree and then back down again. As you can tell from the Sri Lanka guy, it's not that easy. It's not hard picking the coconuts once you're up there, but then you got to go to the next tree. So you got to go down, then over, and then back up again, where a monkey's just going to jump from one to the other. So they're thinking about different ways of climbing a tree and mechanizing that, working on that, or making the trees smaller. And you can do that through science, making more of a dwarf tree so you don't have to climb up as much. But anyway, that's an issue. And it's kind of funny that he used that, because I don't think in Sri Lanka they're using the monkeys as much as they are in Thailand, which they said is almost entirely monkey harvested.
So that is the commercial reality in Thailand, that monkeys harvest the coconuts.
Yes. Our local grocery store, people were boycotting a particular product because they said it was from Thailand and almost all of those are monkey picked. It gets to be quite political. And I mean, you know, we had people on the news showing, oh, no, we treat the monkeys really, really nice and we train them. It's fine for them. You know, so there's both ways.
Okay. That is difficult territory. We are speaking here on LNL about the coconut as a cultural item. Mary Newman joins us, author of Coconut, A Global History. One very famous coconut, Mary, was on the desk of President John F. Kennedy.
Right. That was kind of a cute story. I think it was in 1943, his boat was sunk and he was kind of deserted on an island with his crew. And he carved into the coconut the coordinates of where he was located. And a Solomon Islander took it to an Allied force and they were able to find him and his crew and rescue them. And he credits it to this coconut shell, and he put it on his desk, and now it's on the desk of his presidential library in Boston, I believe it is.
So in World War II, the PT-109 is, of course, the famous boat that sank. So the coconut floated off with the instructions on how to find the crew. How remarkable.
Well, I think he was on the island when he carved it into the coconut, is what I think. And they did train soldiers, or I guess also the Air Force, if they were shot down, to survive on coconuts if they could, and how to start a fire with the husks, and what to eat, and how to open it, you know, that kind of thing.
So it's a survival kit.
It was a survival kit, yes, because I don't think there would be hardly anybody that had a coconut. I mean, back when I'm 72, back when I was about 10, my mother bought a coconut and we didn't know what to do with it. I mean, it was a whole coconut, and I wish she even found it, but we kind of hammered at the thing and finally got it to maybe break open. And there was this nasty water in the middle of it, which, because the coconut was probably old and icky. And we kept saying, ooh, people eat this, you know? So I don't think it was much different for the soldiers either.
I'm sure theirs were substantially fresher, but I mean, well, the story is, yeah, of course, that the Kennedy's crew survived on that an early advertisement for the benefits of coconut water.
Right.
There are other cultures, of course, where the coconut has a really profound significance.
Yes.
Now, I'm thinking here of Hindu texts and culture, the creation story. Perhaps you can tell us this of the coconut palm.
Well, there's actually several creation stories, but my favorite one, though, I guess it's more Polynesian, though, is two boys are in a canoe, and the devil is chasing them, and so they fight because they know the devil wants some food, so they fight, and the one brother kills the other brother, and then he cuts them up into little pieces, and he throws the pieces into the water one by one until the devil is full and is not after them anymore. And so he brings his canoe back to the shore, and he hadn't thrown over the head. I mean, he'd thrown over little pieces, hadn't thrown over the head. So he plants the head in the sand and outgrows the first coconut tree. So it's an origin story.
Wow.
But a lot of there's a lot of cultures that have origin stories. I think India has one that I was going to talk about also. But a lot of them derive from the fact there's three sort of holes, three eyes, or what you want to call it, in a coconut. I mean, even Frida Kahlo drew a painting called The Weeping Coconuts, and they look like faces. I mean, that's what a coconut looks like. They're brown, they're hairy, they got two eyes and another hole that's kind of like a mouth. It's not a hole, it's an indentation. So there's a lot of relationship to the coconut looking like a human head, and a lot of the creation stories build on that kind of aspect of it.
And there is, of course, and this is a wonderful sort of metaphor in some Hindu ceremonies, the breaking of a coconut. What does that represent?
Well, in the Hindu ceremonies, the three eyes, again, have sort of significance. Like the one is the Brahman, the creator, another is Vishnu, the preserver, and Shiva, the destroyer. So you've got the three eyes, meaning those three characters. But to actually break the coconut, Ganesha hears that sound, or it summons him with that sound, and he's the remover of obstacles. So you would frequently break a coconut at the start of a project because you want to, you know, remove all the obstacles for that kind of thing. So we did break a coconut when we started this project, not the very day we started it, but as soon as we kind of started in part of our research. So we did go through that a little bit. It's kind of fun. It's a metaphor. I mean, it's a metaphor for breaking things. And some people think of it almost as a metaphor for breaking the hard shell of where you are right now. You've got to break out of that in order to advance and to move forward with something that you're trying.
Coconut is constraining human ego.
Yes.
I wonder too, was the coconut ever part of the great play of Western imperial colonization? Did it ever have an element of that in its story, especially around, I imagine, India or the Pacific itself?
You know, there's still some concern now that that we need to develop coconuts in a non-exploitive manner. You know, are we just going to have these farmers plant many, many coconuts and not give them a fair price and have them work very hard, et cetera, they might be better off selling their land to developers. So we need to be fair. Even though we're not colonizing, we might be exploiting. So we have to kind of do that.
Or do we need to be wary of big coconut, as it were? Are there big corporate interests behind mm-hmm. some of that demand to plant the coconut on certain areas of land?
Yeah, right.
So that, is that what's happening? Are people being forced economically to give land over to coconut production?
Yeah, it would depend on who would own the land. And I think you probably have to own pretty much. If you just own one or two coconuts in your yard, it's not going to be... you're not part of that whole equation. It's whether you're going to develop a whole area and make it for plantations or not, and be cost effective by doing that, and also taking away their land and then having them go to the cities. Oh, it's definitely a slippery slope in what you're going to end up doing.
So Hawaii, of course, is a place which is prone to the coconut, Mary. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a wonderful story here of the coconut tree, the palm as a bridge to another world. Can you tell us that?
Well, there is a lot of mythology, and some of it does have to do with the fact that a coconut kind of has a very beautiful kind of way it arches out over over the water. And this story has to do with a father who went to one of the other islands. His son missed him. The mother calls to, oh, great coconut, giver of life, God to the travelers. And she kind of, what would you call when you call a god forward? Anyway, she calls and asks for this coconut tree to bridge to another island so the boy can go see his father. But it probably comes from the fact that these coconut trees really arch over the water, and it just is a beautiful thing. Part of the reason they arch over the water is they also get sunlight reflected from the water up, so they're getting sunlight from both places, and they're reaching out to get more sunlight, so being farther away from the other trees. So, but it is kind of a beautiful story, and I think there's a lot of fun myths around the coconut.
Well, Mary, after your immersion in the world of the coconut, do you have a fondness for them still? Do you?
Yes, I do.
Is the coconut dead to you now?
No, I'm sure that this was an important part for most people reading the book, but for my sister and I, it was important. And part of it is that we only got four recipes from my mother. She's passed away quite a few years ago. Hmm. And three out of the four had coconut in them, which was amazing for a 1950s housewife to have three out of four recipes. So she made a coconut cream pie that is still right. Very strong in our nostalgia. We will think of that pie forever. When she wanted to do something for the holidays, you would put coconut on it. So she had this bar kind of cookie, a flat brownish kind of cookie, that she would sprinkle coconut on top. And it just says holidays. It says something special. She'd make this pie, this coconut pie, for special occasions. She'd make these cookies with the coconut on the top for special occasions. When our church had what we call potlucks, I don't know if that's a term you use, but a church potluck, everybody brings something. She would frequently bring ambrosia, which is coconut and pineapple and oranges and marshmallows all mushed together with some sour cream. So for us, we still like it because it reminds me of our mother. So three out of four is pretty impressive.
That is entirely delightful, Mary. And what a way to honour that family memory. Thank you so much. Mary Newman, co-author with her sister, Constance Kirker, of Coconut, A Global History. It's part of the Edible series from publisher Reaction.